sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The unemployment rate at 7.8%. Earnings week starts on Monday, and the first presidential debate, we'll talk about what we think happened there. We have guest Mark Faber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report, and an old friend, Howard Silfen from Oppenheimer. We're going to talk with him about what's going on in politics and exactly what he sees with regard to the outcome of the debate. All this and much more on episode number 283 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, Andrew Horowitz here, and man, we have a lot to cover today, this week, last week, and what's going on moving forward, because a lot of things are starting to converge and come together in a way that's very interesting. A lot of questions about what happened with the job number last week, what's going on with Europe, is Greece going to get the next tranche? Well, it's questionable now. They're saying the Troika's finished, there's a little bit more work to do. The German, there was something in Der Spiegel this weekend that said that, well, they're not quite sure if Greece is going to get their next amount of money. Spain keeps on saying they don't need a bailout, but yet who knows what's going on there. And at the same time, we had another ECB and a Fed-inspired rally on Thursday. Interesting market conditions right now. A lot of distribution going on. Now, let me explain what that is and how we're seeing that. Clearly, we see markets are kind of like just moving along very nicely, a little dip there, a little dip here, a little move up there, a big move up here, and a lot of dip buying. But at the same time, if you notice, you'll see there's a lot of stocks that have been under distribution. And what I mean by that is when you look at the stocks and you see significant downside with little liquidity out there that we've been seeing for a long time, you notice that when stocks start to move, individual names start to move, they get hit pretty hard. Look at liquidity services over the last couple of weeks. Look at a variety of names, like when, you know, even some of the bigger names were hit. Apple was down about 2%, came back up, moved down again. That's not just intraday day trading. There is some distribution going on. Clearly, what's happening is that towards the end of the year, there are institutions, money managers, and investors that are looking to take something off the table from here. Maybe they're thinking that, well, into earnings season, things are going to be questionable. Maybe they just want to take some profits and square off their portfolios. Whatever it is, there is an underlying kind of, signs of distribution. And you could look at that from a market standpoint. For example, Investor's Business Daily tracks distribution on a daily basis. And over the last several weeks, they've tracked five clear distribution days or so for the S&P 500, a few for the NASDAQ. And, you know, what that's saying is that there is a buildup of selling pressure. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to have a massive correction. That doesn't mean there's going to be a big rally. I'm just stating a fact, something to be aware of, because when you're thinking about where the markets are, the direction of it, right now there's a lot of bullishness because of the underpinning and the backstop of the Fed, the ECB, central banks around the world. In fact, I think I told you this before. The rally from last quarter, the market rally from last quarter, can be pinned on about four distinct days, four, that added up to about a 100-point rally on the S&P 500. Those 4 days were started with the ECB when we saw that Draghi came out with his butterfly speech, or the bumblebee, excuse me, bumblebee. Get my insects confused when it comes to the Feds and the ECB, but and central banks. But, you know, they call it the bumblebee speech. That was a big ride up. And you know, when he backstopped and said that he would use every measure possible. Then you had, of course, the Fed with coming out with QE3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then you had a couple of other Fed and FOMC and ECB speeches. Four specific days were the days that really rallied. Otherwise, markets would be kind of, you know, flat. during that time. Now, that's not anything more than a fact. So, you know, the truth of the matter is that there is an underlying optimism that central banks will come to the rescue here. Now, the question is, you know, how long is that going to last and what's that going to do? Well, we'll get to that because I have that listed on my questions for Mark Faber. That's coming up from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom report. But the 7.8% unemployment rate that we saw on Friday and the jobs number that was again ticking lower from previous increases is kind of an interesting situation. At first, markets took it very well. As a matter of fact, it was pretty surprising by all when the expectations were for an 8.2% number and came in at 7.8. A lot of people said, well, it doesn't feel like an economy that's 7.8 and what's going on, and maybe it's a labor participation rate and all this. Well, what happened was that we saw an enormous, monstrous rise in part-time employment. Now, that's interesting because sometimes you can pin part-time employment on a bettering financial and economic condition, because what happens is that companies will start to pick up employees on a part-time basis, not sure what the future holds, but just to keep them so that if things get better, they'll put them on as a full-time. We saw the household survey up 823,000, I think it was 823,000 jobs for the month, which was just an astounding number. But again, about 500 plus or more were part-time. The big question is it new part-time employees or is it full-time that went to part-time? That's interesting. We can look again at the U6 number. That's the truest kind of number that is not statistically changed by the labor participation rate or any other, you know, look backs of seasonality and things like that. It didn't budge, still at the 14% range. And what happened was that markets really initially liked it. But what was really interesting at first was that the dollar started to move lower. Now, if we have an economy that is strengthening, you would think that the nature of currencies and the backdrop of a stronger economic situation, especially because we saw a service index much higher than expected, it was about 55 versus 53. I was pretty surprised with that, but I was very pleased with that. Manufacturing, on the other hand, has been really slowing down. So we have much better service, much worse manufacturing, and all of a sudden this good employment number. Now, within the employment number, you did see a lot of losses in the manufacturing area as well. So again, you got to think about a lot of services coming on. And what happened was that the dollar was weaker, and the stock market started moving up and kind of really moved up nicely throughout the day on Friday. But all of a sudden, it started reversing towards the end. Now, why was that? Was it the news that Greece may not get their next tranche of financial bailout? Was it the idea that you know, maybe Spain is not going to get a bailout so soon, they're going to hold up? I mean, there's a lot of things that happen. Well, I think one of the things that happened is the dollar started finally to rise. If you look at the day and you track the differential between, or I should say the correlation, really, between the S&P and the euro, and we tweet this quite often because it's fascinating. There's a direct correlation between the direction of the euro and the S&P 500. It's almost in lockstep. I think I've shared that with you before. But if you haven't noticed it, it's kind of interesting to chart. We do it on a 5-minute, 10-minute basis and look at kind of where things are. But it's pretty darn close when you look at that and you look at the various movements of the both of those together. As the euro moves down, so does the S&P. When it moves up, so does the S&P. Now, you could say the opposite of when the dollar drops, the S&P starts moving higher. But that's against a variety of currencies. Now, what's interesting was that during the day, the dollar started rising and stocks started selling off. As a matter of fact, the small cap index, which did in fact call out the day before called for a short position. It was below a very key resistance line. It couldn't break above, and then it moved lower. It went up through the next level, went up through that support line, and that which was initially resistance. And then it came on to its next level of resistance, held there for, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, and then started to reverse lower. In fact, closed lower for the day. S&P, which was up probably close to 8 or 9 points for the day, closed down lower. Dow finished up a bit. That was from a last-minute run in the last 10 minutes of the day. But that was very close to negative as well. NASDAQ finished much lower. Apple dragged down the NASDAQ 100 down about 60 basis points or so. And what I found really interesting was that there was a lot of media jabbering. There was a lot of conversations about, wait a minute, 7.8%. That seems absurd. Jack Welch was on Twitter with a pretty significant and rather bold commentary. And then later on CNBC, how basically these are made up numbers. These are manipulated numbers concocted from a Chicago-style politician. Something of that, he said. Again, we're going to talk about that in a little while with Howard. But I thought that, you know, a lot of people really had some skepticism almost because it was too good. Or on the other hand, maybe they're saying, hey, wait a minute, is this going to be the end of QE? Now, I think this is one of the reasons that Bernanke's been coming out and consistently saying that even if the economy improves, they're going to continue with their quantitative easing. This has been well telegraphed. So, you know, there's this kind of bias right now that the numbers are too good and it's questionable. On the other hand, you're going to see that all over the front pages, 7.8, international markets will like that clearly. But at the same time, you have to wonder how much will the dollar strengthen into that and what does that mean? Now, a couple of things I want to mention before we get to the next. I want to talk about earnings. But first of all, the podcast awards, the annual podcast awards are happening. The nominations are just already starting. And I think that goes to October 15th, I believe. Go over to Podcast Awards right on the business area and the People's Choice. Type in The Disciplined Investor and put the website address. And then at the bottom, you can put a DH Unplugged for education or for general. And then you go to the bottom, put your name and your email, press submit, and then go to your email and confirm it if you get something back. And then what happens is that after the nominations are tallied, they're going to have an actual vote. All the nominations that go in and the top nominations will be part of the final awards. And then you have to vote and you can vote once per day. We'll tell you more about that. But please do me a favor. If you enjoy the podcast, go over to podcastawards.com and put in The Disciplined Investor for a nomination. The other thing I'll mention is that Stocktoberfest is way underway, and we've already talked about a variety of stocks. We're doing about two per day, so if you did put in your particular stock, go check it out on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top, we left a post so you could see what is being scheduled to be released on a daily basis, and there's a link on each stock symbol, the ones that have been released, so you can just click over and find out what the analysis shows. We did Starbucks and Seagate. We've done, let's see, what else did we do? We were going to do Kraft, but because they broke, they split apart, they were no longer able to be looked at. We did, let's see, what else did we do? A few retail names that I recall we did last week. There's so many names out there. We, you know, 15 or so that we did last week. But we did do Coach last week as well and a few others. So check that out over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Every single day we're posting it. You could also follow those and get the immediate updates on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. Just my full name is my Twitter handle. All right, so let's talk about earnings. Earnings season does start next week and, of course, gets kicked off with officially, quote-unquote, with Alcoa. Now, we have a really interesting first week, as we always do have, because it gives you a smattering of different sectors and what things are looking like. Because we start out on Monday with three really interesting names. We have Chevron, and these are just highlighted ones. Chevron, Yum Brands, and Alcoa. Now, Chevron's going to give us a little bit of a taste for what's going on in the oil and gas and the distribution side of things. And there's a lot of discussion how this will be the first quarter of a negative overall earnings compared to the previous quarter for the S&P 500, mainly dragged down by energy companies. So we're going to see what actually happens here and how far analysts brought down their estimates and what the companies can do. Don't forget that companies have a clear vision of what analyst expectations are, and analysts don't have as clear understanding of what the company is going to put out. So the analysts have less visibility, and companies obviously are doing their best to meet or beat analyst expectations, and they provide whatever information they can, maybe lowball a little bit so they could beat. Now, and that's something that goes on all the time, by the way. So we have Chevron, then we have Yum Brands. Now, one of the biggest issues about Yum Brands that you have to understand, this is we'll call it a restaurant and casual dining stock, is that they have a tremendous footprint in China, in Asia. What we're going to see here is exactly what's going on in terms of the spending in Asia, and in particular China. This is going to be a good read-through when we see the earnings. Now, it's not just whether they beat or meet on EPS or revenue, but also we have to look at what has happened over the last several quarters and on a year-over-year basis. It's important to watch the trend on this to see what's exactly happening in China. And Yum is going to be a good place to look and find out what's happening there. We also have Alcoa coming out. Alcoa is supposed to have a flat quarter. And earnings are 0.009 cents per share to the positive side is what expectations are. Now, obviously, this is going to be the materials area focused on aluminum, but that goes into a lot of things like cars. And, it goes into a lot of goods that we see in manufacturing, et cetera. So it's going to show us a global point of what's happening with raw materials. Then we have the next day, we have Costco coming out, which is going to give us a read on the consumer in the U.S., in particular the consumer, that's looking for lower priced products. We have Host Hotels and Resorts, interesting, because it's going to show us what's happening in the leisure industry in the U.S. And we have also AdTrans, so that's going to give us a little bit of technology, telecom, and Progressive for the insurance, and particularly for the property casualty insurance. The next day, on the 11th, we have Fastenal. Fastenal is going to give us a really good read into construction. Fastenal is going to give us kind of a read on how much construction is being done and how much goods are being bought, and if there's any margin squeeze in that area from the material side. J.B. Hunt will be coming up. That's going to talk about transportation, one of the biggest in the transportation area. And again, talk about margins and what's happening with the cost of fuel and really how much they're doing in terms of truckloads, et cetera. And then on Friday, we have two major banks. We have J.P. Morgan and we have Wells Fargo. We're going to actually find out how much of J.P. Morgan's profits were hit by that major trading fiasco they had. And we're going to find from Wells Fargo what's happening more in the consumer area and how they're benefiting or not from low rates of mortgages and how that's really doing to their bottom line. So you have a real good smattering. We don't have a lot of retail next week. That comes in a clump in a couple of weeks. But this is a good read on not only domestic, but the global economy to give us a read-through of what to expect moving forward. Now, if anything is similar to what we've seen in the past, we've seen Alcoa come out. They beat a little bit. They go up, and then they start trailing down again into the next quarter's earnings. Banks seem to, beat, and then there's kind of questions what happens. But banks have been on fire lately, and with low rates on mortgages, even though the yield curve has flattened a bit, it's starting to kind of widen and benefit banks again. So really good things to look at and really good things to take note of for next week, aside from the economics, because earnings are going to trump all that. And this quarter's earnings are going to be a really important factor in terms of stock market progress to the upside or the downside. Let's get to our first guest, why don't we? And we're on the phone with Mark Faber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report. And I want to talk to him about a lot of things that he has been discussing lately and talk about the economies around the world and some of the things that he's seeing. Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing well, thanks. Listen, there is a lot of headwinds that are going on around the world. A lot of people are scratching their heads saying, yeah, but the markets keep on kind of doing very nicely. And what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it depends, because some markets have performed fantastically well, like Thailand is up from the 2009 lows by 257%. The Philippines, almost the same. And then you had 4 months ago, markets like Portugal, Spain, Italy, France, Greece, that were right at the 2009 lows or even lower. So it's been selective. And the U.S. over the last 18 months, admittedly, has just about outperformed anything else.
Mm-hmm. And is a lot of this due to just value plays or people are saying, finally, okay, there's a backstop? Because, you know, the ECB came out with some very big language, but from my take, they haven't really spent dollar one per se yet, right?
Well, basically, all central banks have increased their balance sheet. In other words, they have monetized government debt and other securities, and they have pushed interest rates to essentially record lows. And as you know, in the U.S., interest rates in real terms, inflation adjusted, are negative. So this is a fundamental factor that we have to consider. If interest rates are negative, inflation adjusted, then cash is endangered species. And that pushes then people into all kinds of assets, from paintings to collectibles to real estate to equities and bonds and commodities and precious metals.
Now, you've been around a long time, and one of the things that I've noticed over the last, we'll say, 4 or 5 years is that central banks' focus seem to be much more on markets than they are on the economy. The old days was the whole economy, right?
They would like to boost economic activity, but in order to do that, and they've done that for quite some time, certainly in the U.S., they target asset markets. In other words, after 2000, when the NASDAQ broke down, the Fed was actually actively recommending another bubble, supported by the new Keynesian Alan Krugman and Paul McCulley of PIMCO, that said a housing bubble would be at this stage very helpful. Well, we know now how helpful it's been. It's been
right.
The worst 10 years in American economic history in terms of personal income growth. And we had essentially a stock market that moved sideways, and we had a lot of people losing essentially their homes. And this is, for many families, not very pleasant if they have children that go to school in the neighborhoods of their houses.
Mm. So where is the, if you can classify where the worst markets in terms of economies and maybe markets themselves are, and where the biggest problems are, and then the best economies and the best markets, what's your pick? And that can be a wide range. That could be from real estate, gold, or, you know, whatever you want to do, or regionally.
Well, basically, very clearly, we have big structural problems in countries like Spain, Italy, Greece, Portugal, in the sense that they're not particularly competitive, and that they have very high unemployment and a huge debt burden. So these problems simply don't go away overnight. And also, we have a problem in Europe in the sense that we have really an entitlement society. And like in the U.S., we will have the problem of unfunded liabilities coming due, plus the demographics of Europe are not particularly favorable. So there are structural problems, and I think if I look forward for the next 10, 20 years, the standards of living for the median household in the U.S. and in Europe will not increase. In fact, I think it will go down. So that is essentially an outlook for these two large economies, Europe and the U.S., that is not particularly favorable. Doesn't mean that there won't be any opportunities to make money in these countries.
Right.
I'm just saying, economically, they're not particularly favorable. And the more favorable economies are, in my opinion, in Asia, where you have a young population. I mean, you said you were in Cambodia. The country, whether the world is in recession or not, will continue to grow from a very low level, but it will grow. And it will develop, and eventually it will become like Thailand, or even having a higher standard of living than Thailand, possibly. Who knows? The same will apply to Myanmar and to Laos and so forth. And so we have still economic development in some regions of the world, but in terms of investments, I don't think that asset prices are very cheap. We had this money printing going on, and investors have largely discounted the money printing by pushing up asset prices. In other words, in the U.S., the stock market is up more than 100% from the 2009 lows. And precisely a year ago, on October 4th, the S&P was at 1,074, and we are now at 1,440. So we had essentially short-term and long-term a huge bull market, and stocks are no longer very cheap in an environment of a global economy that is, without any doubt, slowing down very rapidly. And in some cases, we are technically already in recession. Say in Asia, we are at a high level of economic activity, but we may be below the peak of 6 to 9 months ago.
Yeah. So one of the things about when I look at the United States and you talk about Europe and you talk a lot about the demographics and many of the factors that are involved with a growing economy, like you say, would be the opposite of a young economy. But then you have to look at Japan. And Japan, is Japan the roadmap for the U.S. and for Europe, in particular Europe, U.S., because we seem to be following their entire lead of how they try to reinflate their economy and reinflate things, but it just never worked?
Well, they didn't inflate sufficiently. That's why the yen has been such a strong currency. Had they expanded the Bank of Japan's balance sheet to the same extent like the ECB expanded its balance sheet, or the Fed, I suppose the Japanese yen would be weaker, and we would have another set of problems in Japan, but we would have more inflation. But it would not help Japan, because if the yen weakens and interest rates begin to rise, then the government has a problem with the interest payments on its government debt, which is about 200% of GDP.
So when you look at the situation in terms of money printing and the amount that has been done, and at the same time in the U.S. we're getting the quote-unquote official numbers that show no inflation, how is that all possible?
Yeah, well, I mean, you say the official numbers. The official numbers, of course, do not reflect the true cost of living increases of the typical family. Maybe Mr. Bernanke doesn't eat any food, and maybe he doesn't need any energy. But most households I know in the world, they need energy and they need food. So these two prices are up, of course, substantially over the last couple of years. Insurance premiums are up substantially. Health care costs are up substantially. Just as an example, taxi fares in New York, they just went up 17%. And the tunnel fees from New Jersey to New York earlier this year went up 50%. So you have a lot of price increases that may not show up in the consumer price index. In addition, they massage the way they calculate the indices. As an example, nationwide in America, rents are now up, residential rents are up 9% year on year. But it doesn't show up in the CPI. But now you have to consider the people that just lost their homes. They have no access to credit. They can't buy a house anymore. They have to go and rent, and now their rents are up 15% in San Francisco and 9% nationwide.
But I guess with all this as a backdrop, we do have to admit that in the U.S., the balance sheets are better for companies. Banks are, you know, who knows, because of their lack of transparency, but, you know, at least they're better than they were back in 2008,
sure.
2009, right?
I didn't say anything different.
No, I'm just stating a point. That was all. So what about China? Is China really slowing down?
Well, I'd just like to mention about the banking system. What very few people still talk about is the time bomb that exists in derivatives. This is, I mean, long-term, a huge problem in my opinion. And I'm not sure how it will be solved, but I suppose that one day there'll be again a crisis. Secondly, there has been an improvement in bank balance sheets, correct? But why? Partly because the banks can essentially get your money on deposit and you don't get any interest, and they can lend it out or speculate with that money and take positions and so forth and so on. So it happens the banks have improved at the cost of the savers, of the retirees that have, say, large amounts of cash on deposits in money market funds and so forth. They have now no income. So basically the action of the Fed has been biased towards the financial sector and has put savers at a disadvantage.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, listen, we have a lot of people we know that are questioning where they get their next dollar from because they can't get the yield, and they're just pushed into all sorts of different mechanisms and investments because they can no longer get a yield on their CDs.
Yeah, sure. Look, zero interest rates, they encourage speculation in everything from paintings to commodities to equities to bonds and so forth. And these are symptoms of inflation. Inflation is not only an increase in consumer prices. It can manifest itself in an increase in other prices as well, you know, of assets.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. Mark Faber from the Gloom, Doom, and Boom Report. We'll put a link to your newsletter on how to get that on the website. I want to thank you so much calling. We're talking to you from in Thailand. It's pretty late over there. So I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Well, there you have it. Interesting discussion, I think. You know, he has a unbelievable following and has been pretty interesting to listen to on his overall commentary when it comes to not only the ECB, not only the Fed, which he's pretty negative on, but also about his global perspective. So I want to thank him for coming on. Check him out over at the Gloom, Doom, Boom Report. You could just look that up. We'll have also the link on the website. A couple things I wanted to talk about before we get to our next guest, and I thought was kind of interesting what happened this week. If you noticed, first of all, in Iran, there was this, you got to love this. The value of their currency dropped about 30-something percent to the dollar. And that was a big problem, obviously, you know, but what do you expect? I mean, this is a country that essentially is we're in a quasi-war with them to kind of shut down what they're doing. And it seems that there's a variety of, whether it's computer viruses or now currency action against the country, trying to squeeze them to do the right thing, to stop with their nuclear ambitions. We'll see what that happens. But, you know, in a country like that, I'm not quite sure where you get to, because with the leadership as it is, we'll see. But it is an interesting, process that's going on. I guess the best way to describe it, it's very hard to really pin it on what's going on with all these subversive types of things that happen with the country, you know, with their nuclear plants and the viruses on their computers, and now a currency situation. Who knows what's going to go on with food costs? Who, you know, it looks like there's the idea of a revolt being prompted to occur there, which, you know, I can't put it past anybody to make that happen. The other thing that was interesting, that I thought was interesting, that happened last week was there was a very quick and very significant drop in the India markets. There was about a 16% drop on their index in a matter of a few minutes, blaming it on a fat finger, blaming it on a software glitch. It came back and it was fine. It affected about 15 or 16 different stocks. But again, we're seeing the same situation play out over and over with the computers, high-frequency trading, algos, et cetera, that are set to do certain things when it comes to markets, kind of go a little bit bonkers. And this is becoming more and more of a nuisance in markets of late, and it's something that we really need to kind of consider. Already we're seeing that there is a request to ban high-frequency trading in Hong Kong and a few other areas. I think it was also in some other Asian country. Now, I can't remember which one, but there is a growing voice when it comes to the whole idea of high-frequency trading to really do some regulation about it and to stop it, because the concern is that, you know, while the group that benefits from it is saying, hey, you know what, they are providing liquidity to the markets, but at the same time, you know, we have to wonder really what the benefit of it is. And, you know, I just don't see it aside from them making money on it. So we'll see what happens with that. But a couple of interesting news points I thought that would be interesting to mention. Before we get to our next guest, what I thought we would do is just have a little time for something important. You know, we try to give back to the community whenever we can, hopefully that you do the same thing. And our very own Kevin Hoffman is going to be undertaking an enormous task, a big bike ride to benefit a important charity. Well, Kevin, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so what we're doing is I'm doing a cycling ride, and it's for the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center. And this is the third annual Dolphin Cycling Challenge, which is basically a two-day tri-county charity cycling event. The purpose of this ride is really just to increase cancer awareness, encourage healthy hobbies, and raise funds for the University of Miami Sylvester Cancer Center.
So how many miles are you going to be, I said biking, I can't say that, I guess, it's not the right word, but how many miles would you be cycling?
Yeah, it's not a motorcycle ride, you know, it's a bike ride.
Right, how long is it?
Well, there's 2 days, and I'm planning on doing both of the days, and the total mileage will be 170 miles. So we'll be riding, you know, up to Palm Beach and down to South Beach and back up again, kind of thing.
So you got one of those, like, water things, the Camelback things?
Oh, yeah, I got the Camelback and got the, you know, the water bottles and the whole bit, you know.
Cool. All right, so I think the important thing is that, you know, folks, if you want to help out and sponsor the ride, is what we're asking you for, actually, and sponsor Kevin's ride. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot, just whatever you can give. We're going to put some information on the website over on the show notes for this particular episode. So, Kevin, what's the deal, though? How does the sponsorship work?
Yeah, it's very easy, actually. You just log on to the www.ridedcc.com, and if you just search for my name in the upper right-hand corner, Kevin Hoffman, it'll take you to my page where you can donate using a credit card. It's very easy. You know, no money. You know, $1 is not too little, and, you know, as much as you have or much as you want to donate, it's very easy, very simple. And like Andrew said, we'll just put the link in the show notes, and you can go right to it. And every single 100% of the funds are donated to the Sylvester Cancer Center, and they are potentially tax deductible for those of you who itemize.
Are you going to, like, have pictures for us so we can see, like, are you going to be live tweeting? Are you going to be Instagramming? Are you going to be having, like, the iPhone on the whole? How are we going to communicate how this is going? And how?
Yeah, I think what we could do maybe is we might be able to, during the ride, via different cycling apps, you may be able to just track to see where I am and, you know, how fast I'm going, how far I'm going. And maybe we can work out some Instagram, something or another. That would be cool. I've never really done that before, though.
I just like to see when you get up to, like, mile, I don't know, 75, 80, how you're doing.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do, like, a live post during that event. It's not till November 3rd and 4th, so I got a little bit of time, but I have not had very much time to train. I'm going to be honest. I've been pretty lackadaisical.
Well, you've been pretty busy with that. Yeah, that tough boss that you got.
Yeah, who is that guy?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so folks, if you can, I'd appreciate it, and Kevin would appreciate it, and it's important for cancer awareness as well as finding a cure, of course, eventually for this horrible disease, that if you want to, we don't ask for any subscription fees for this podcast, of course. If you can go over, we'll put the link on the website where you can donate directly, and really, if you can do it, and do it now because, you know, a couple of days you'll probably forget about it. Make sure to give a couple of bucks, sponsor the ride, and do what you can to help out this very important cause. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, everybody's affected by cancer, at least, you know, either some friend or some family or, you know, may have been yourself. But, you know, it's affected somebody one way or another. So we've got to do our part. And unfortunately, we can't really cure cancer, but, you know, we can raise money for those who can.
Right. I appreciate it. And I'm glad that you're doing the cycling. And I'm sure you're going to do great with that. So thanks a lot. And gang, really, please do what you can to help out this important cause. And as I promised in the beginning of this conversation today, in the beginning of the episode, that we're going to have some talk about what's going on with this whole political arena in the U.S. You know, we have a lot of conversations that have been crossing last week about the unemployment rate and the debate. And I thought that a great person to bring on is a good friend of mine that I've known a very long time. His name is Howard Silfen. He's a financial advisor with a major financial house. And Howard, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Andrew. How are you?
Great. Listen, I want to get into some of this discussion because you and I, we have similar but opposing opinions on some of the politics out there. And I just wanted to bring up some of the things to the folks that are listening about your thoughts on the thing. Like, for example, what I thought was amazing was the night of the debate, you and I were talking during the debate, and you said, you know, if Romney's looking real good, there's going to be a nice rally moving ahead. And I thought that was interesting because you often are on the other side of the aisle. And I kind of wanted your take on why you think that there possibly could be a good market condition if, you know, people start embracing the Romney ticket versus maybe the Obama ticket.
Well, I think most people who are in the business, who are professionals, who have been around for a long time, you know, their persuasion is mostly on the Republican side. And I think they would like to see a victory for their guy. And I think, for the markets, they've always been friendly to, you know, to Romney's policy of lower taxes. They love stuff like that, you know, dealing with the deficit. Whenever the economy, you know, gets comments from the right side of the aisle on those things, it usually does better, at least temporarily.
Right. So when we looked at the debate, we were looking at it, and I think both of us, you know, I try to come in nonpartisan, you know that. I try to come in looking at both sides and all that. And we looked at the debate, I think we were both pretty much astounded at how well Romney did compared to maybe what we thought they would do, and all how we would do, and then also how poorly Obama did.
Well, you know what it is? It's not that we didn't think Romney would do well, because he was tested in his primaries, and he did well. And if you go back and you look at 4 years ago when Obama did his debates, he didn't even do well back then. Mm. But the thing I think that shocked most people in the Democratic Party was how unprepared he was. And not his answers. I'm not talking about the substance of his answers. But you would think a guy like that would come in, the President of the United States would come into this debate and be prepared. He would have coaches who would say, listen, the basic thing in a debate is when someone's talking to you, look at him, have eye contact. He was so unprepared for this debate is kind of what shocked more Democrats than anything.
I mean,
and let me just say one more thing.
Yeah.
I think if you look at some of the polls say Romney got a couple point bounce out of this. I think the next one is very important, because I think if he blows up twice, like a lot of people can look past his first one and go, okay, you know, Romney came off the bottom, he bounced a little bit. But if Obama comes out and he really bombs the next debate, there's going to be some problems for him.
I'd be very surprised. I mean, we know how great that Obama is as an orator, speech giver, generally a debater. I mean, generally speaking, although, you know, he kind of comes off with the same lines over and over, you know, the education, the alternative energy, you know, building infrastructure. I mean, does he have to come up with something new here?
You know, I don't think so. I think a lot of people have really made up their minds going into this election. I mean, I think the slice that's left in the middle is so thin that if you can move a needle 3 points either way is going to be the difference in this election. So I think everyone's so polarized. Everyone's got their candidate. You know, like I said, the slice that's still left in the middle, he had enough of a lead going into this that even if they cut into it a little bit, that's fine. But if he bombs again, that 1 or 2 percentage points again could change the election in favor of Romney.
But, you know, at the same time, now all of a sudden we have a couple days after we have this another jaw-dropping situation where we see the unemployment rate drop to 7.8, which was far below, I don't think anybody called that level. And, you know, you look at some of the reasons why, you could say, well, all right, we had some just a surge of 550,000 part-time employees. You still had some losses in manufacturing. And at the same time, you didn't see much of a change in the labor participation rate and all that. I mean, how do we get to 7.8? And then we could talk about the Jack Welch discussion.
You know, to tell you the truth, I can't tell you how you get to 7.8. And I can't tell you, I didn't complain when they went from 8.2 to 8.7. you know, these numbers are so erratic. You could get a new number in a month from now, and they can change a 7.8 number. But the bottom line is people are going to hear 7.8.
Right.
And they're not going to hear the 114, and they're not going to hear it came from there. The average voter and the average person in this country is just going to hear 7.8. And that's going to help Obama. I mean, no matter how you cut it, that's going to give him a boost in the polls.
But what about the people that don't have jobs? I mean, are they kind of, where do you think they're sitting? I mean, are they still hoping and praying that some of these programs work and that the Obama's, general economic plan is actually working? Do they get swayed by this? Or are they just kind of more concerned about their own situation?
What they're praying for is that somehow this government finds a way to work through these problems together and comes up with solutions for the American people.
Yeah.
It's not going to be one party over the other. People have to come in, they have to compromise, they have to sit down, they have to at some point agree to the Simpson Bowles or parts of it. You know, you can't balance this budget. The only way to get out of this mess is through growth. There's no austerity, there's no lowering or raising of taxes. You got to get back to some growth in the country, you have to get back to hiring and jobs in this country, and that's the only way to get out of this.
Yeah, I agree, because the fact is that starting to cut hurts this one, and starting to tax, you know, hurts that one. And you can make an argument, I think, on either side of, you know, whether or not trickle-down economics works or not. And, you know, if you start taxing the wealthy and what happens there. But clearly we need, you know, something that we haven't had. I mean, obviously it would be very nice to see a budget enacted, don't you think?
But they've been playing this game with budgets forever. I mean, this is not the first time they've been playing this game. It's not a matter of that, Andrew. It's a matter of everybody sitting down. You know, people can throw numbers out there. They can do food stamps. They can do unemployment. They can come up with. Anybody can skew numbers to any way they want. People want to see progress. They want to see a government that works for them. Okay? You can't just come out. Your only platform can't just be lower taxes. I'm running on lower taxes.
Right.
It can't be your only thing. Now, listen, at some point before, the Democrats came up with, we'll cut spending 10-1 for tax increase. A 10% reduction in spending for a 1% increase in the upper tax brackets. We couldn't even come to a deal on that. That's the main obstacle in this country. People are scared to death because there's a government that's not functioning.
Right.
If you ever hear guys from Moody's and and everyone says their main concern is the financial cliff and a non-functioning government in this country.
I mean, I agree. It's hard to watch the ineffectiveness of anything that, because of the polarization and the party lines that people are sticking to, rather than what seems to be what's best for the country. I mean, that's as I see it.
Well, look, you know what? This is a big election. No one's going to move the needle in either party to help anybody here until the election's over.
Yep.
So that's the bottom line. And then you just have to pray that after that, they get together and they do what's right.
Yeah, well, okay. What's going to happen with the vice presidential debate? We have Ryan, who is, I guess is... As far right as we can expect to see someone who would be put on the vice presidency. You know, some people say he's, you know, clear Tea Party. Some people say he's a little bit off. Then we have to the left, we have Biden. You know, he's been around for a long time. His tan looks great, by the way, recently. I don't know what he's doing, but he's playing some games. He's looking good, looking very healthy, very tan.
I think he's been in Florida.
Yeah, obviously. So what is your outcome on that? I mean, I can see, you know, my view is, you know, it looks like Ryan's going to just plow this guy over. But am I wrong?
You know, people look for, if you're a Democrat, you want Biden to do well. You're going to look for him. You're going to understand his passion. You're going to understand that, you know, he's going to make gaffes in this thing because that's Joe Biden.
Yep.
But you live with the guy. He's from Pennsylvania. He was an average guy from Delaware. You know, he commuted to D.C. He didn't live in D.C. Joe Biden's a likable guy. Okay.
Yep.
You know, Ryan's going to come in there and he's going to have his facts and he's a pretty self-assured guy of what he thinks and where he wants his country to go. I don't know how big people look at the vice presidential thing. I really can't, unless there's another blowout here and someone doesn't say something stupid. And believe me, if anyone's going to make a mistake, you know it's going to be Biden over Ryan.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Well, the last election, I mean, we looked at that because, you know, obviously when Sarah Palin was brought in, it seemed like the entire election, the entire platform fell apart.
You know, I think Sarah Palin was her own case. I think that was a totally different, that was a polarizing pick. That was a, you know, that was a Tea Party pick. Not that Ryan's not. I just think this one, I think people are looking to the next Obama-Romney debate. I think that, like I said, I think that's much more critical than this will be.
I hear you. So listen, what about, you know, Jack Welch comes out. This is a guy who has a history of being in industry and obviously, you know, with GE, and he's got his, by the way, clearly, he's got his baggage and he's got skeletons in the closet, right? Or maybe the skeletons are out of the closet. But he comes out and it was I was pretty amazed about this, outwardly saying that the unemployment rate of 7.8 was BS. It's Chicago style politics. They made up the numbers. He tweeted it. He went on CNBC. I mean, is that what it's coming down to, that we got to start, you know, yelling conspiracy?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly what it is. You know something? You have access to Twitter now, okay? Something comes out, it pisses you off, bang, you throw your comment up there, you have to live with it and stick with it.
Right.
Okay? And people say things and they make mistakes and they would love to backtrack on it. No one backtracks anymore because it shows weakness and I can't and I'll look bad. You say something wrong, you're stuck. And I watched him on a couple talk shows yesterday, and he almost tried to walk back from the comment on one of the channels that I was watching. But he, you know, he made the statement. He has to live with it. He doesn't like Obama. You know, there's a lot of guys out there who hate the president. I mean, and it's vicious now. This is a vicious time for people out there, and everyone's letting it go.
Yeah. So, you know, you talked about the food stamps, and one of the things that you did that I do notice is that we have, I think, the highest level of people on food stamps now, and more importantly, there is an extremely high level of people that have gone on permanent disability with Social Security. They've come off the rolls of unemployment, the extended unemployment, and gone right into, you know, potential disability payments. You know, that is interesting. You know, you have these transfer payments, and you have this situation where people are getting money, so that's okay. But how long can we really keep this up?
You know, I watched a show this morning, and there was a guy who came back from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of a million soldiers who filed for disability.
Mm-hmm.
He's up to 26 months now waiting for disability.
Really?
That he hasn't been approved. And he's sitting there, and he's living at his mother's house with his wife and his child. They have one of the bedrooms. He's on the couch. This is a guy who served this country, okay? He got a brain injury. Is what the result of what his injury was in Afghanistan. They awarded him, they did part of his disability payment. They didn't go through the whole thing, but they only gave him $600 a month right now. They're still reviewing the rest of his application. But like I said, he waited 26 months. They're giving him $600 a month. He served this country. He's on a couch. He's a disability guy. Now listen, no one, you know, people taking food stamps in this country, nobody wants to take food stamps. It's embarrassing. If you were making a living at one time, and now you're getting food stamps, and you're standing in a supermarket with maybe your neighbor standing behind you, it's an embarrassing thing. You know, hopefully we'll get back to a point in this country where that number will come down dramatically. But this is not, it's kind of sold sometimes by the Republican Party that these, you know, everyone's a freeloader on food stamps, and, you know, that's just not the case. I mean, people don't want to be on it. There'll always be a segment of a part of the population that's going to take. Okay, we all know that.
Right.
But you know, people want to get off this program. They want to get off unemployment. They want to get off food stamps. You can't live on it. It's ridiculous. You know, I don't even know if Americans know that, like, even in Florida, they pay $275 a week. You can't even pay your rent.
I totally agree with you, by the way. And one of the things that I have brought up many times, and I'll bring up again, is my concern about you know, the structural unemployment issue versus, you know, a cyclical issue.
Right.
You know, and I brought this up, and I really do believe this. As a matter of fact, you know, on Twitter, I every once in a while I write about this, and it will hit Twitter, and I got a lot of people coming in to, you know, talk about this, that, you know, there is something going on where you have automation, robotics, blah, 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 the things I always talk about that is essentially getting rid of jobs. I mean, they're just getting rid of jobs. I'm not talking about offshoring jobs. I'm not talking about offshoring manufacturing. I'm talking about,
right.
You know, pretzel.
You're talking about structural changes where the internet is taking over for people hiring jobs.
Right.
I mean, there's, you know, people have lost their jobs and they're in their upper 40s, their low 50s. These people are in trouble.
Well,
let's
talk directly to a point here that you know of very well. Okay. you know, when we had automation that happened in the securities market, when we went from, to decimalization, there was an entire group of market makers that were wiped out, right?
That's correct.
And the fact—
Actually, there's none left at all.
Right. So the thing was, what was that because of? Was it because of just decimalization? No. It was also because of automation of trading through technology.
Absolutely.
So,
but now the question, well, here's the second part of that question. Does that automation do a better job than people did? Where is the trade-off between a better execution, okay, versus faster execution?
I agree. I totally
agree.
You
know
what I mean? No, I agree.
It's a lost industry. Look, there's a whole lost industry on Wall Street, and there will continue to be, okay? And there's, I don't think there's any way to bring those jobs back, quite frankly. You know, some of these, you know, Frank Dodd resolution. I mean, the problem is Obama passed a lot of good things, but they all need work.
Right.
You know, when you hear people talk about the health care bill and I'm going to scrap it. No, don't scrap it. Fix it.
Right. Well,
you see, that's the part. And the same thing with Frank Dodd and the regulations on Wall Street, all the regulations.
I think one of the big things that really pissed off people in America was the Nancy Pelosi, hey, don't bother reading it, it's a good deal. I think that kind of really put a lot of people off on, like, wait a minute, I don't even know what's going on here. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know what's going to happen to my health care. And, you know, you got that kind of pushing it in and cramming it in, and the way that they went through a very obscure ruling to actually get the bill passed and all that. It just, the whole thing was it didn't feel right. It was distasteful to a lot of people. Now, obviously, it does good for a lot of people. I'm not disagreeing with that, you know, with the, preconditions and healthcare for everybody. And I got that. Okay. You know, what's really fascinating, though, is the healthcare industry has been exploding in growth. And we know why. You know, HMOs, hospitals have done very well. Pharmaceuticals, biotechs have done very, very well. You know, who's the loser here, though? At the end of the day, who's the loser? Because if you're going to have something that's going to, you know, hopefully cut costs over time, how is it going to cut costs if everybody keeps on making money on it? Something doesn't make sense to me.
You know, I think you just have to wait. I don't think anyone can say how this is going to play out, the healthcare thing. You're forcing people into exchanges. You're forcing people to get insurance. That's why these HMOs have been doing well and the hospitals are doing well. I mean, that's why it's moved that way. Okay? Who's the loser? Maybe there is no loser. There is no loser. There doesn't have to be a loser to everything. Maybe it's a win-win. Maybe some things, but everything in this country has looked like if you win, I lose. If I put this through, you win, I lose. It's not the way it is. You know, the same thing with the regulations that they're trying to impose in Wall Street. They're probably a little too restrictive. They probably could be loosened up a little, but you know what? They had it coming to them. What went on?
Yep, I agree with that. Listen, we also saw that, you know, the same thing that's been going on with the question about high frequency trading. We saw a 6-second or an 8-second drop in the Indian market by 16% last week. You know, again, maybe it's a fat finger trade. Maybe it was some other kind of glitch in the system, and then the stocks came back, you know, very similar to the, you know, it was like a mini flash crash. But, you know, you talk about winners and losers. I mean, doctors have been, you could say the doctors got overpaid for years and they milked the system and all that. And I can't disagree. If I was a doctor, maybe I disagree. But, you know, doctors are definitely hurting. I have a lot of doctor friends. I was out with one last night who said, you know what? I had a consult tonight. I told the guy I can't do anything for him. Why? It was complicated, and he was only going to get like $500 to $1,000 for a major surgery because it was an HMO deal. Now, not critiquing him or his policy. I mean, that's the kind of thing that has happened.
Well,
you know,
here's what you did. Here's what you did. You switched health. See, this is the thing. Everyone goes, the government will be involved. The government. When you switched healthcare over to a for-profit corporation,
mm-hmm.
What did you think would happen? You know, if United Healthcare, okay, is supposed to report this year $1.60,
mm-hmm.
and they somehow are being told that they're going to miss by 5 cents,
yep.
when they have to come up with that nickel, because God forbid that they miss by a nickel and they beat the stock down to nothing,
right.
Okay, because that's what goes on Wall Street now. If you miss, you're through.
Right.
Where are they going to get that nickel from? You know what they're going to do? They're going to raise your deductible from $1,000 to $2,000. They're going to increase your copays. So everyone goes, it's a government. What about these companies that are now in charge of healthcare? I went to a doctor for an MRI, you know, maybe about a year ago in New York, and they wanted me to have two different types of MRIs. And the health organization that I had my healthcare through denied one of the tests. Mm-hmm. That's not the government.
No,
this
I agree.
This is them cutting costs.
But it's also the whole nature of what's going on right now, that the Fed has gone away from being economically centric and looking at that and focused on the economy to focused on markets. And that is going on around the world. And that has also solidified the fact that, you know, companies have to meet certain criteria and they're under the microscope on a regular basis by investors. And it has gotten so far afield that, you know, the expectations, not listen, what's really funny, you got to admit, is if you have a company that they're looking at 160, right? Well, last quarter they made, let's say, $2. The previous quarter they made, $2.50 and $3 and $4. Let's just say that this is one of their worst quarters. Let's just say, okay?
Right.
And they come in a little bit above, the stock goes crazy. And you're thinking, wait a minute, this stock is higher than it was when they were making $3 a share.
Right.
And I don't, understand. They come in on. Now, there's other companies that you can see that miss. Apple, as a clear example, they come in, they say, listen, here's the deal. We missed. I mean, if you looked at Apple's numbers on the last quarter and you didn't know it was Apple, you'd have been horrified.
You know, as long as I've been on Wall Street, I've seen them miss numbers and guide up. I've seen them make numbers and guide down.
Right.
Okay? I can't tell you why, after trading for 29 years, that why, stocks get hit and get taken and why the sentiment is here and it's almost a bizarre thing. And now with program trading driving prices and everything, it makes even less sense.
Yep.
It's a very tough market unless you're a long-term investor. And then it's hard to be that in this economic type situation that we're facing to even, want to be in stocks. Okay, not knowing where the market will be in a year and a half or 2 years from now.
Yep.
It's just a very hard environment to be an investor in.
I agree. I mean, the last couple of years have been kind of one of those that you scratch your head on a regular basis, And you and I get up in the morning every once in a while, and I get a text from you, why are the futures up? And I say, what's my response? Tuesday, Wednesday.
Usually the euro or the dollar or something
stupid.
Overseas you normally come up with.
Yeah, something stupid. This is why. It's Tuesday. It's the euro. It's 3 days before the Fed meeting, whatever. Anyway, Howard Silfen, I appreciate you talking all about this. Great stuff on the political environment and the markets and all that. Great, talking with you. Financial advisor for a major house here down in Florida. We will put some reference to him on the website. Great trader. Great friend. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Andrew. It was great being part of the broadcast.
All right, okay? All right, bye-bye, buddy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So we covered a lot of area, a lot of topics, a lot of things that hopefully give you some food for thought on what's going to be going on here. Obviously, the political situation in the U.S. and in Europe are going to be shaping markets pretty dramatically over the next course of several months. We have the political elections here. We have the continuation of the ECB trying to get the European situation better. We also have the fiscal cliff. We have a lot of things happening here, some headwinds. We'll see what's going to happen with China and how poorly their economy continues to be showing up in their various economic releases. And then, of course, we have earnings season. I mentioned that at the top of the show. So hopefully there's a lot of things for you to chew on and for you to understand and to get some grips with. I'll tell you also that Stocktoberfest, again, is on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, so check that out. And if you haven't done so, you got to get your 14-day free trial of Trigger Point Research Alerts, where you get alerted through email, through text messages of stocks that are breaking out, breaking down, bouncing. Really cool stuff. And for your free 14 days, you get all of that to test it out. So check it out over at TriggerPointResearch.com. Thanks for joining me. We'll be here next week with another hopefully insightful and informational show and a follow-up on some of the earnings that will be coming. Speak to you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for being with me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.